It's the question rabbis, ministers, priests, and counselors fear most. Why me? Where was God? How could God let this happen? Where was God at my mother's bedside or my child's accident? For many, the question of pain and suffering is a barrier to a serious relationship with God or even involvement in religion. From a personal point of view, this is the question with which I have struggled the most. You all have learned something about suffering sitting through my sermons over the last 5 years. This is such a difficult problem in Judaism and larger in the world of religion that it has a special name called theodicy. The problem is the existence of evil, tragedy, and suffering. If God is all good, all powerful, and all just, how can good people suffer? People usually harp on this problem as a proof that there is no God. But of course, atheists have to explain all the good and pleasure in the world. The very fact that we expect some measure of justice implies an underlying assumption of God, an underlying assumption that there ought to be order and logic in the world. If we hold that there's no God, we should not be disappointed when there is no justice in the world. I'll try to give you both a traditional view, more modern views, and some of my own views. If we look at Scripture, specifically at the Torah, the answer is quite simple and clear. From the second paragraph of the Shema in Deuteronomy that we actually don't read in the Reformed tradition, we get a very extensive discussion. It says, if you obey the commandments, God will provide rain and grass for you, your crops and your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied, no problems. If you don't obey the commandments, no rain, no crops, you'll be banished from the land. Deuteronomy in chapter 28 has a list of blessings and curses, which are even more explicit, promising everything from environmental disaster to hemorrhoids, to boils, to madness, to blindness, to dismay, to starvation, cannibalism, slavery, poverty, dispersion, and dissatisfaction. Once on Mount Zion, there's a small Holocaust museum, and I toured it years ago, and I saw a jacket that was required to be made by a Nazi, a guard, who required a tailor to sew this jacket of a Torah scroll that the Nazi could proudly wear as he strutted around the camps. But the tailor had the last laugh on the back of the jacket with a list of the curses that I just read. How are we to understand these words of Torah? They are clearly not true. We wish that it were that simple. Perhaps we should understand the you, not in the singular, but in the plural. Maybe God's talking to the entire populace and not just to individuals. Maybe we should understand this the way I like to understand it, as an evolution of our relationship with God. In the Bible, it's like we're an infant. God is speaking to us in our spiritual infancy. These Torah verses sound like a warning to a small child, like don't touch the stove or don't play in the street. If you play in the street, you'll get hit by a car. The parent doesn't make this terribly nuanced, doesn't say, you know, if you play in the street, there's a 10% chance that a car may come along and a 5% chance that the driver might not see you, leading to a 0.5% chance that you would be hit by a car. No, it's quite simple. It's Deuteronomy. If you play in the street, you're going to get hit by the car. So a later book of the Bible makes this a little more nuanced, the book of Job. Briefly, to tell the story, God and Satan, yes, Satan, he is in our Bible briefly, mainly in this book, have a bet. By the way, the gematria, the numerical value of the word Hasatan, is 364. 364. And the mystics say that's to show that Satan has influence on us for 364 days of the year, but not on one, not on Yom Kippur. So God and Satan are having this argument, and they have a bet. And they bet that God speaks favorably of his servant Job and says, Job's a terrific guy, loyal and faithful. And Satan says, yeah, it's because he has it so good. Take away all of his good stuff and he won't be so loyal and faithful. So this is what happens. Job gets terribly ill, loses his children, has a nightmare of a disease, and his friends come and visit him in silence for 7 days after the loss of his children. This is one of the origins of the custom of Shiva. And Job asks the question, why me? And Job refuses to give up faith in God or even curse God in spite of his friends who spout Torah. His friends say, look, you must have sinned. If you hadn't, if you've sinned, so God is punishing you. So repent from your sin and you'll be okay. But Job knows he has not sinned. Job knows he's unjustly suffering, yet never loses faith in God. He says, Adonai giveth, Adonai taketh away. Blessed is the name of Adonai. So Job demands that God show up and act as judge and defendant and jury in the trial of Job versus God. And God does show up. And in a powerful and beautiful speech, basically says, I'm God, you're not. How can you possibly understand my ways? That is enough for Job. But God adds a very important element at the very end of this book, where he renounces the simplistic statements of Job's friends and says it's more complicated. In fact, God was ready to kill the friends, but Job intervenes for them. The conclusion, quoting Gunther Plaut, is the problem of suffering is beyond human understanding. Yet at the end of the work, God himself declares that Job has spoken rightly. God's reputation is not to be defended by distorting the truth. The book of Job takes Jewish theology one step further. The child, the Jewish people, is growing and can handle a more sophisticated answer. It's not as simple if you play in the street, you'll get hit by a car. But trust your parent, we know best. Compared to you, we're all-knowing and all-powerful. Or a more popular version of this theological statement, because I'm your father, that's why. By the way, the Talmud specifies that the high priest read the book of Job on this evening, on Erev Yom Kippur, as he is preparing to enter the Holy of Holies. So the Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah, in the Talmud sums up the traditional view. It is not in our power to explain the tranquility of the wicked or the suffering of the righteous. To know God is to be God. The rabbis of the Talmud conclude that if God is all good and all just and all powerful, and good people suffer and evil people don't, therefore, there must be an afterlife. God has a plan beyond our understanding. Think of it as an analogy of doing experiments on animals to cure diseases. Think of it as a baby suffering as it gets inoculated against diphtheria, tetanus, and smallpox. There's more going on than we can understand. On some levels, this is a comforting answer. God is in control. God has a plan. Justice will triumph in the long run. So now some more modern thoughts. First, it's important to understand man-made, human, evil, and natural suffering. I spoke on Erev Rosh Hashanah about human evil. The answer is free will. As I said at that time, we're free to make hospitals or gas chambers. How could God let Hitler do what he did? How could God let Pasteur and Salk and Mother Teresa do what they did? The question is not how we can have faith in God after Auschwitz, but how we can have faith in humanity after Auschwitz. But natural tragedy, disease, earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, that's the problem. Harold Kushner writes a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Notice the name of the book is not Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, but When, How Do We Respond? And he writes the book as a result of his own story. A young conservative rabbi and his bride, their firstborn son, develops a disease called progeria, rapid aging, and dies a horrible death at age 14. He concludes, read the book, that God can't be all good, all just, all powerful, and my innocent son, or yours, or Job, suffer. He concludes, God is not all powerful. The laws of nature are set, and God does not violate them to spare good people. If some idiot shoots a bullet into the air, the path of that bullet is determined by my old career, physics, not my new career, theology. I read some years ago of a young woman, a daughter of a minister, doing charity work in the inner city, killed by a stray bullet in Los Angeles. Even if you're a saint, even if you are the tzaddik ha-tzaddikim, the saint of the saint, the righteous person in our time, you still have to take your meds. You still have to buckle your seatbelt. You still shouldn't text and drive. God is the source, however, of our strength. of the people who comfort, cure, and support us. We should not ask, why did this happen to me? We should not ask, what did I do to deserve this? But we should ask, now that this has happened to me, what am I going to do about it? God does not cause the cancer, the earthquake, the car accident. There is random evil and tragedy in the world. God has to do with our response, not with the cause. To continue the analogy of the growing child, God says to us, as a parent to an adult child, I don't have the power to protect you now that you've grown, but I have taught you how to deal with life, and I will always be there to provide love and comfort and give your advice. So call me once in a while. We'll sit, we'll talk, I'll listen, you'll listen. It will help, I promise. My major argument with God, and I have plenty, is why did you construct the world so that we seem to only grow through pain and suffering? Why does it seem that the greatest moments are only after tragedy? Jewish history illustrates the point. Abraham, you know, God's first words to Abraham are Lech Lecha, get out. To be Jewish, you must leave the comfort of your father's home. Joseph becomes a mensch only after years of prison. Israel gets the Torah only after 400 years of Egyptian slavery. The Talmud is codified only after the temple is destroyed and we're sent into exile. The Kabbalah is created by Jews that were expelled horrifically from Spain. And yes, Israel becomes a state 70 years ago in the aftermath of the Holocaust. Some histories even closer to our day and age make the point. In 1979, 5.5-month-old Laura Lamb became one of the world's youngest quadriplegics when Laura and her mother Cindy were hit head-on by a repeat drunk driver offender traveling at 120 miles an hour. As a result of the crash, Cindy and her friends waged a war against drunk driving in their home state of Maryland. Less than a year later, on the other side of the country in California, 13-year-old Carrie Leitner was killed at the hands of a drunk driver. 2 days prior, this offender was released on bail for a hit-and-run drunk driving crash. He had already had 2 drunk driving convictions with a 3rd plea bargain to reckless accident. Enraged, Carrie's mother, Candace Leitner, and friends gathered at a steakhouse in Sacramento. They discussed forming a group called MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. Thus, MAD was born with a name that would sweep the nation. Today, there are 600 chapters, 2,300 laws. Alcohol-related deaths are down 43%. Another example. In 1993, the kidnapping and murder of 12-year-old Polly Klass leads to the Polly Klass Foundation and Search Center. In 1994, the brutal rape and murder of 7-year-old Megan Kanka led to Megan's Laws requiring notification of the public when dangerous sex offenders are released into the community. 1996 kidnapping and murder of 9-year-old Amber Hagerman led to Amber Alerts. All these moms asked, not why me, but what do we do now? My own history tracks this same idea. You know, there is no life untouched by pain. I always repeat a quote, not from a rabbi, but from a rabbi's mother, Helen Telushkin, of blessed memory, who said, the only people I know that are perfectly happy, who have no serious problems, are people I don't know very well. You meet somebody at a cocktail party, I'm great, you're great, everything's great. How come? But you get to know anyone on any level of depth, and you realize there is no life untouched by tragedy, and it's certainly true of mine. My late wife had Huntington's disease, a progressive neurological and genetic illness. I could see it coming years ago. One of the reasons for my interest in Judaism in my mid-30s was this sense that I had to make deposits in a spiritual strength bank because I knew I was going to make some mighty withdrawals down the road. For over 20 years, I watched Carol decline from a pretty, bright, funny, loving, energetic wife and mom who had her master's in family counseling to someone in a nursing home for a dozen years, bedridden, almost completely unable to communicate or understand. I watched my children lose their mom in pain, compounded by the knowledge that this genetic disease hangs over them as well. I can remember crying out to God in the depths of pain, God, why don't you do something? Do something to help me. How can I possibly bear this alone? Where are you when I need you? And God answered. One major point about prayer, by the way, is you have to shut up. The word says Shema, listen. You need to shut up long enough to hear God's answer. And God answered me in a story which is particularly relevant given the images of television these past few days. They tell the story, some of you must have heard it, I'm sure, of Max, a pious and loyal Jew who is in the path of floodwaters of the hurricane du jour. And there's an order to evacuate, and Max says, I'm not worried. I have faith in God. I've been good and pious all my life. I'm staying. Well, the waters are rising. The sheriff comes in the Jeep, asks him to evacuate. Max says, I'm not worried. God will protect me. God will answer me. Well, they're coming up. The boat comes by, the Cajun Navy, and they ask him to leave. He's on the second floor. Nope, I'm not worried. I have faith in God. I'm staying where I am. Well, now he's on the roof, and the Coast Guard helicopter is there, but he waves them off. Of course, he drowns. And now he's before God. And he says to God, God, where were you? Why didn't you do something to help me? And God says, Maxilla, who do you think sent the Jeep, the boat, and the helicopter? So God says to me, Michaela, who do you think sent you your family, Sonia, your friends, the congregation you belong to, the financial resources and spiritual strength to deal with this? And I was strengthened and I was comforted. In the course of this journey, I spoke to some of the smartest rabbis I could find, including Larry Kushner and Mordechai Finley. Their words, for your pain, we can only offer sympathy and support. But what you must do is take the lesson you learn and teach it to others. They taught me that we have to move on from why me to what do I do now. So here I am. I am smarter, deeper, more experienced, more empathetic, more spiritual, more religious, a better listener, a better father, a better friend, and on this amazing career path and spiritual path, all because of my late wife's illness. It makes me grateful, humble, angry. It makes me crazy. Is it worth it? Not a chance. I would give up all of my depth and wisdom and insights in a second to free my family from Huntington's disease. Just as I'm sure that Rabbi Kushner and the parents of Polly Klass and Megan Kantka and Amber Hagerman would as well. But you know what? God doesn't give us that choice. The only choice we have is our response to the pain in our lives. Will we grow deeper or grow bitter? Will we comfort others with the insights we've learned or torture them for not removing our pain? Will the experience open our eyes to the blessings that we have and the pain of others, or sear them shut to anything but our own needs? Here's what I've learned. I've learned that a life worth living is one necessarily filled with both pleasure and pain, highs and lows. Most of us have both, incredibly blessed and occasionally cursed, and the two don't cancel out. I've learned the truths taught by our parents and grandparents. Our most precious possession is our health. I've learned that there is enough natural pain in the world to last us all for a good long time. Thank you very much. We don't need your additional contributions. How many times have we heard stories of and lived through gratuitous pain, the senseless pain caused by parents, children, ex-spouses, and ex-friends? The rabbis of the Talmud teach that the temple was destroyed due to gratuitous hatred of Jew against Jew. How much energy is spent driving those we should love crazy? I tell you, this is reverse alchemy. It is not turning base metal into gold, but gold into dreck, into garbage. There is no greater sin. You out there have the power to comfort those around you or drive them nuts, to help create little islands of peace and respite from the natural ills of the world, or create little hells from which there is no escape. God gives us a world with plenty of natural tsuris, problems, and challenges us to heal it. How do you think God feels when God sees us use our talents to make it worse? O God in heaven, you sit in judgment above us. Give us the strength to resist the urge to bring more evil and pain in the world. Guide our hands and hearts and lips to bring love and comfort to hands that are tired, hearts that are broken, and lips that cry out in pain. 24 hours from now, we will be relaxing with friends and family, having broken the fast of Yom Kippur. May we see them through new eyes made clear by your teachings. May we enter a year committed to comforting and supporting all those in our lives, our families, our friends, our community. May we see ourselves as doing the work of your hands when we do so. And may we be worthy of inscription in your book of life for good, happy, peaceful, and healthy year. I wish you a tzom kal, an easy fast, and a good year. Amen.